Today, budget, smudge it. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today I'm joined again by Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
Very good. And congratulations on your recent news.com article. You're obviously penning quite a few things for them now.
Yeah, it's quite nice. I mean, you know, a few months ago, I never would have thought that I'd, you know, sort of break into the mainstream and be talking about all this sort of stuff. And hopefully this weekend, I've got another one coming out regarding housing prices. So let that sink in.
Tremendous. Well, perfect timing, of course, with everything that's going on. So I guess we should have a bit of a decompose on the budget today, but I guess also take account of the most recent information which has just come out, which shows that first-time buyers are booming, according to the statistics, and the Reserve Bank is a bit twitchy about financial stability.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because we're seeing some very different, almost conflicting data at the moment. We've got the ABS saying that, you know, that owner occupiers are borrowing more now than they've ever borrowed before, which is absolutely huge in a month. But then by the same token, we've got the RBA saying that overall housing credit growth is down near record lows year on year. So it really, once you sort of unpack it all, it paints a very, very different picture.
Yeah. So just to be clear, the ABS data today is new loans written. Right. And so that's basically coming in the front of the hopper. Right. So first time buyers, we know, are reacting to the home builder and the homeland packages and, are basically trying to get into the market and take advantage of all those. So in a way, the government stimulus for the first time buyers, bribes, as I've already called them a few times, right, is definitely working. You can see that. And when I speak to first time buyers, they're definitely there. But got to remember two other things. Firstly, there are loans that are actually on deferment at the moment, which are being capitalized. So those balances are going up as well. So you would expect first-time buyers and loan capitalization to move the numbers up. So the offsetting number is people repaying their debt, right? And that's the thing, of course, that is never really talked about. But there are more and more people who are looking at the situation and thinking, gee, I'm not sure how these are going. Of course, many of those will have accessed super. They will have perhaps received, JobKeeper or even JobSeeker payments, and essentially are putting them against their mortgage, against the fact that this future is uncertain. And so that's why the gross number and the net movements are so different. And it'll be very interesting to see whether that first-time buyer momentum continues. They announced, of course, another 10,000 first-time buyer, 95% loans ahead. So that will probably be something. But the home builder was not extended in the budget. So effectively, that's going to have a natural endpoint at the moment. So remember this. We are in a debt-driven economy, and the whole Ponzi scheme is driven simply by you bring more people in to borrow more so that they can build houses, so that the property market can continue to expand. So you need a rate of change of credit positive to be able to create that momentum. And the financial numbers from the aggregates, the RBA number, is 2 point something. It's as low as it's ever been. And that's despite the money supply being 11% higher than a year ago. So something is not actually functioning as people normally think it would.
No, and just on the point of the ABS numbers, Alan Oster from NAB came out with a podcast last month, and he said that what we're seeing is that while we are approving a lot of loans, that's not actually translating into borrowing in a lot of cases. People are saying, yes, well, okay, you've got an approval from NAB, you can go borrow $1 million, you can go buy a property, but people aren't actually pulling the trigger on the loan itself. So it's entirely possible that what we're actually seeing in reality is very different to what we're seeing in the ABS figures.
Right, because, of course, what we're talking there is effectively approvals, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think that, you know, there's any number of reasons why people may be choosing to do that. You know, it's a relatively uncertain environment. They don't know about their employment prospects or about, you know, maybe they're going to... their hours may take a cut, or, I mean, it's a pretty uncertain time. You know, I mean, 40% of the workforce is on JobSeeker or JobKeeper. So, you know, it makes sense that, that people would sort of, you know, put the best foot forward while they can.
Right. But here's a thought. I don't know whether you've noticed this, but between the end of October and November, the income support overall will drop by 38%, right? Next year, it drops by another 60%, right? So we are in the situation where all the government stimulus and support to households is being sucked away. And there's very little in terms of the budget to replace that. You know, okay, there were a few tax cuts for those people who are fortunate to have jobs, but the whole structure of the economy is shifting dramatically. And so the question becomes, will business be able to ramp up and basically create sufficient momentum to be able to pay people more, to be able to offset all of those government supports? And it's looking to me more and more unlikely that that's going to be the case.
Well, if you really get into the nitty-gritty, into the, say, some of the ABS payroll numbers, it shows that medium businesses have recovered up until about July, and then they've started to stagnate and fall off a little bit. Yep. And then small businesses got to the same, to a similar point in July, and now they're rolling over and more people are losing their jobs in small businesses yet again, while large businesses are actually doing very, very well because they've got access to credit, you know, they've got access to the bond market, to other forms of, you know, to other forms of borrowing. But if you look at the budget very much incentivizes companies who are already making money. It's like, you can offset this against your profits. You can offset that. While it doesn't really do a whole lot for the sort of average small and medium business that's really, really struggling, that do, that really needs to get on the road, you know, back to back to growth and prosperity. You know, I mean, sure, they might be able to hire someone under the age of 35 and get their nice little extra bonus, but realistically, it's not something that's going to be, well, a seismic shift that's going to help these businesses that need the help the most. And that, I think, is where the budget really falls down. There's very, very little for the, I mean, you can say, oh, okay, you know, this is the math, this is how much overall is going to businesses, and that's fantastic. But that's not what's actually happening in reality. It's all going to end up at the top. Yep. You know, it goes to businesses who have a turnover of up to $5 billion, which is huge. While, you know, there are small businesses who are going to sort of suffer in silence, so to speak.
Absolutely. I was very, very disappointed with the budget. I felt that they missed an opportunity to take a step forward rather than a step back. They're trying to sort of replay the last 10 years again and basically just hope that the thing runs differently this time, right? Well, I'm not sure it will. You're right, the top end of town will do very well. I wouldn't be surprised if we see more job losses in senior roles and suddenly we find a whole bunch of new apprentices being hired at the bottom to, you know, I mean, no reason why that wouldn't happen. Look at JobKeeper, look at the way that translated to ProfitKeeper for a lot of retail players, for example, at the top end there. So I would expect that to be the same. Nothing in there for small and medium enterprises. And if you're not actually creating much in the way of income at the moment from your business, then buying new kit and offsetting the loss is irrelevant, right? Because there's nothing to offset it against. So that's really not going to help very much at all. The problem I see more broadly is that this is all about supply side. What you're trying to do is to try to actually somehow fire up businesses to sort of start doing what they should be doing. But there's no demand, right? Demand is the problem. And in fact, in the Council of Financial Regulators quarterly minutes, they specifically said the big problem we have at the moment is lack of demand from businesses for credit. And to an extent, it's also true in the household sector too. I know some first-time buyers are definitely stepping up for that reason, simply because they were given the bribe and everybody wants to get into the property market. But more broadly, there is very little on the demand side. So if we are in the situation where your job is uncertain and you might therefore decide to save more rather than spend more, the likelihood is you're just going to hunker down. And therefore, there should have been much more focus on the demand side of the spectrum rather than the supply side of the spectrum. And frankly, that is probably the most critical issue I've got with the budget. It's focusing on the wrong things.
Well, I mean, you need to do is look at the household savings rate. While I expect that will come down as we see some certainty surrounding the end of lockdowns and all that sort of stuff in Victoria and elsewhere, I think we may see some movement downwards in that respect. But at the end of the day, it's still extremely elevated compared with where it was before. Hmm. We've seen, very near negative savings rates before here in Australia in the past. And it speaks volumes about where people are at. And I think part of the problem is that you look at these sort of very broad measures, say like retail sales or stuff like that. Now if someone goes out and spends $15,000 on a stereo because they're loaded and, the stock market's gone up, that shows up in retail sales. Of course it does. But by the same token, you've got these people at the bottom on the lower rungs of society who are struggling. And we really do have a two-speed economy in that sense. And I don't have the data for here in Australia, but if you look at the data in the US, if you look at the confidence breakdowns based on income and net worth demographics, you see that people on the bottom rungs of society are very concerned about the economy. They're very concerned about their future. They're very, very worried. But if you look at the top rungs of society, where people are looking at things like rising house prices in premium areas, rising stock prices, they're all saying, "Woo, this is all fantastic. Everything's going to recover wonderfully." While in reality, I think that things are far closer to what the people on the lower rungs of society are seeing, because we're not going to be able to keep throwing. I mean, what did Bank of America say? We're not going to be able to throw $21 trillion at the economy every 6 months forever.
Well, that's right. But all the strategies really around the world have tended to float to the top, right? So that the top few percent who had all the stocks, and all the investments have actually been supported and have done very well, but everybody else not so much. It's certainly true in the US, where the unemployment rate is still very high and where incomes are under huge pressure. The other point, of course, in Australia, there's been very little income growth ahead. If you look at what the budget was suggesting, I think very little income growth. Plus, of course, the fact that the migration numbers are down as well. So effectively, we're going to have less people potentially coming into the country, which means that the overall growth is going to be a lot lower. So essentially, there is very little to talk about how this is going to get turned about. And I just think that the budget is a short term, get us to the next election and over the line sort of strategy, and a bit of tax cuts, well, that'll help, won't it, sort of strategy, rather than something more appropriate and more creative for the long-term future. We've discussed this a few times before about short-term versus long-term. But interesting also to understand that, the Labour Party's response, which was pretty much to say, well, yeah, we pretty much are okay with what you said, but we'd like some additional stuff, right? So a bit more focus on old workers and women and childcare, which is all good and well intended, I think. But to me, the both sides of politics are on the same page here, which is same old, same old.
Overall, purely in the sense that Labor is supporting much of the measures in the budget, I would agree. But I think that they did come to the party with some interesting proposals. Mm. Say for example, talking about revitalizing manufacturing, building sort of heavy vehicles here, doing things like fixing the electricity infrastructure so it's ready if we do see a further revolution in household solar, which is extremely likely going forward, and we do see sort of decentralized power, sort of creation. I think they made some good points there. I think that they offered a far more comprehensive vision than what the Morrison government did. And I think that's largely positive. But I think the problem for Labor is that, relatively speaking, they're wedged. The participation of the unions in the creation of JobKeeper really screwed them. That if the unions hadn't have been involved, if I was Albo, I would have nailed ScoMo to the wall for those huge, huge corporate profits we saw in Q2. And we're probably going to see a similar trend in Q3. Mm. I mean, $15 billion worth of profits flowed from JobKeeper, according to CBA. I mean, and that's an important thing to remember too, when they talk about, oh, we only saw a 7% reduction in the size of the economy. Well, guys, if you guys take out JobKeeper, the JobKeeper payments, which propped up corporate profits, which feed directly into the national accounts, it would have degraded by 10%. And that's one of the reasons why Australia didn't do so poorly compared with the rest of the world. But, Labor, just back to the point, rather than going off on a tangent, Labor really, really screwed, the unions' participation screwed them. Because they could be really going after them, saying we could have done it like Britain, we could have saved loads and loads of money, and we could have placed a focus on broader outcomes, on covering everyone we humanly possibly could, covering the arts sector, covering casuals, covering universities. And they could make a very strong argument, one that I think mathematically adds up, that it would have cost less money, they would have got better outcomes, and they would have had more money to spend on other things.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that there was more of a strategic overlay to what Labour was saying. I agree with that, and some of their thoughts around what needs to be changing for the future, I think, is dead right. But I still think that you're right, they're stranded a bit in terms of no man's land at the moment. But, you know, $1 trillion is the amount which essentially is being paid out over the next little while. $1 trillion, right? And my question is, is that $1 trillion being well spent or not? And I have to say, I don't believe it is.
Well spent, that's a good one, mate. No, I mean, obviously, you know, the answer is no. You know, you look at where all this money's gone, even just over the last 6 months. It's been a great grand old piss up for corporates and the wealthy. You know, we have spent. You know, I mean, like I look at these deficit figures, you know, on a quarterly basis, and you go back and you compare them to like 1941 through 1945, and it's like back then, you know, Australia ended up with like the fifth largest navy in the world, the fourth largest air force. You know, we built an enormous industry. You know, we got women into the workforce. We achieved amazing things, and we defeated Adolf Hitler and the rest of the Axis powers. And now we've spent a similar amount of money, and we've achieved absolutely nothing. You know, it's quite frankly insane that that was ever an acceptable outcome in Parliament. And I think it speaks volumes about the issues that we have with our political system. The fact, and well, not just our political system, it's been the same around the world.
Yep.
You know, we spent trillions and trillions and we've got absolutely nothing to show for it. And I think that's really, really quite sad because, you know, unless we do see some sort of crazy inflationary event where, you know, we inflate away the debt, this is going to be something that our children and grandchildren are going to be paying for decades to come.
Well, 30 years. I know it's interesting that one of the bonds that the government issued today came in, you know, 0.25% is the coupon on the bond, and they achieved a price of 0.3, right? So we know that the ability to raise funds at very low rates exists. So that means that the total debt servicing is relatively low for quite a long period of time until maybe rates go higher later. But the quantum, the $1 trillion, right, in round numbers, right, think about what would happen if you divided that by the number of people in Australia, right, and translated that into a dollar figure. And then think about if you gave that directly to consumers, right, how different the world would be. And maybe I'm advocating here universal basic income, right? I'm basically saying trying to put all of this through business and hoping that business somehow magically translates it through to wages and business growth seems to me to be very, very difficult to defend, right? I think there was an opportunity to do more direct stuff in terms of to support households and businesses in the short term, and then lay some strategic foundations, and maybe some of the things that Labour will talk about are some examples of those, for the future. But the whole structure of the budget was ideologically very much the same old, and you know, we'll have very little to show for it. And that's my concern, other than a very large debt.
Yeah, well. I mean, that's just it, isn't it? You know, that, you know, we've had a government that is ideologically opposed to deficits run the biggest deficit in Australian history in dollar terms.
Yep.
And we'll run an even bigger deficit next year. And it's quite fascinating to watch, really, because, you know, you can see the wheels turning in the coalition party room. You can see them all just going, oh, I'm not really sure about this. This really just goes against, you know, sort of the gut feeling of the coalition party room and the Nationals as well. But overall, it's really quite hard not to be quite bearish, to be honest with you. You know,
hence your wallpaper.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. No, it's difficult because none of this is really going to offer long-term support to the economy. Hmm. Now, things like the business tax offsets and stuff like that, being able to write assets off instantly and everything, that I'm sure that for some very, very large businesses, that's going to help. That we're going to see things like, you know, like new trucks or new machinery fly off the industry. Fly off the shelves for big industry, but it's not going to offer the long term help that we need for the economy. It's not going to create. I mean, like, this is something that I've been going on about in, you know, privately for quite some time. But we're basically destroying our consumer base. You know, every person that doesn't get back into work is a person that it's economic potential that we've lost in the long term, because that's what happens when the participation rate declines on a permanent basis. And it's one less consumer that's going to be out there to go to the local shops or to go buy a new car or to do any number of things. And to be completely frank, and not go down the bearish rabbit hole, but purely based on the data, looking at Roy Morgan's figures for last month, 152,000 people left the workforce and 56,000 people lost their jobs. Now, by any measure, that is an absolute disaster.
Hmm.
You know, people losing their jobs is bad. It's very bad. But people leaving the workforce is even worse, because it means that we're losing that productive capacity and those skills potentially forever. And especially with older people, you know, people over the age of 50, and particularly people over the age of 60, if they lose their jobs, the chances of them getting them back sometimes are worse than less than half.
Yeah, well, I agree that the older age group is definitely at risk. I'm certainly seeing that in my surveys. And, of course, quite a few of them were actually on quite large incomes before this all happened, right? So these are some of the people who've still got big mortgages and suddenly find that they're out of work and then can't get another job and then have to try and work out whether they're going to retrain. Can they retrain to somewhere else? And, of course, all of those support mechanisms that were in the budget were below 35. So there's nothing above basically 35. So that's a big deal. Look at the mortgage footprint. And it's actually quite scary to see what proportion is actually held by people who are actually losing their jobs at the moment. So I'm seeing this structural unemployment. I've been talking about this for 2 or 3 months. I'm seeing it even more in my data now. So that's pretty concerning. But the other point is this, that as you watch the economy, struggling with the continued lockdowns and the fact that the tourism sector is still locked down and the education sector is still locked down. The question is, where are the growth segments in the ahead? Because that's what we should be focusing on. And I didn't see any really reference to that at all from the budget as to where we're going to invest. Okay, they've got this manufacturing sort of thing going on, but it's a relatively small number and it's relatively trying to pick winners. No broad-based thinking about where that growth engine is. And, of course, we've still got China and potentially China decoupling more rather than actually getting more from us ahead. So, it looks to me as though we've actually laid a bit of a bear trap for ourselves with this.
You make a good point. There's nothing is probably an exaggeration, but there's very little there, you know, in terms of these incentives that you're talking about. And, I mean, even the most bullish Aussie economists will admit that we are a country that is ostensibly driven by houses and holes. Maybe throw in some LNG and gas, but that's basically the biggest drivers of our growth in recent years. That and immigration, of course. But beyond that, and now that, as you point out, you know, we've lost those, you know, the international tourism and the international students. You know, I mean, that accounts for something like 4% of GDP. You know, the government claim in the budget that we're basically going to get back to pre-COVID levels in relatively short period of time. Yet they also said, yet Josh Frydenberg also came out the other day and said that we're not going to open the international borders until the end of 2021, until late 2021. And I'm not a rocket scientist, but it's kind of difficult to reconcile the fact that we've got this wave of insolvencies coming. We've got 4% of the economy that's basically out of commission for the foreseeable future. And we're talking about, one, housing prices rising, and two, the economy bouncing back, and three, the idea that we're somehow going to get unemployment under control in relatively short order. Mm. And I don't know, but maybe I'm lacking the same strategic vision that Josh Frydenberg has, but I don't see how 3.5 million people who are currently supported by JobKeeper are suddenly going to be able to just go back to work and without any government support whatsoever. Like, after the budget, I did the math. only they're estimating that only 6% of people on JobKeeper are going to lose their jobs. Now, if that's true, why the hell are we spending tens of billions of dollars on JobKeeper? It's either A, a waste of money, or B, that the budget figures are completely wrong. So either way, they're screwing up.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you that I did a similar calculation and came to the same conclusion, which is that something doesn't gel, right? So either the numbers aren't the numbers or there's just a disconnect. And I'll tell you something else I did. I looked at the... Because you can get JobKeeper and Job Seeker data down to a postcode level, right? So I actually have got all that data, and I mapped it, and I mapped it back to my mortgage stress data, right? And there's a huge correlation, not surprisingly, but obviously, if you think about it, right? So we're seeing high levels of mortgage stress in areas of the country where there's a high representation of Job Seeker and Job Keeper. So what that tells me is that we're already seeing, even now, even with the government support, problems in those areas. But now that support's being withdrawn, so you would expect to see the mortgage stress and rental stress and investor stress get worse in those areas. And they're pretty much predictable, you know, Western Sydney and, east of Melbourne, up and down the Central Coast, so those places like that. I can't see how any of the things that they've announced is going to turn any of that around. So for me, the next 6 to 12 months is down rather than up from this point.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that although I will say that there is a little bit of a caveat in that. I've looked at the numbers for job that they said. Treasury stated that in Q4, the number of people on JobKeeper was going to decline by 1.3 million down to 2.2 million recipients. Mm. I'm not saying that. Mm. I don't think that's going to happen, to be completely honest with you. You know, I mean, since Treasury made that estimate, the number of people on JobKeeper up until the start of September rose by about 220,000. So not only because of the Victorian lockdown, but that was a big factor. Now, we probably saw a similar increase in September as Victorian businesses get pushed to the wall. And so I think that and I've spoken to a few other people, you know, statisticians about this, and they reckon that the chances of that drawdown in the number of people on JobKeeper is pretty unlikely, to be honest. So I think we're going to see more income support for more businesses for longer in that respect. But by the same token, the payment rate has still been cut.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still, and not only that, but I think what we are going to see in the next 3 to 6 months is we're going to see people who did squirrel away their JobKeeper money or their JobSeeker money. We're going to see those people drawing down on those savings. Yep. So I think we will see some little bits of support there because people did save a lot of money.
Well, there was a lot of money to save. I agree. Absolutely. There was. Although, of course, it wasn't uniformly spread. If you look across the, again, my data set, right, there were groups that actually were able to save big. There were many others that didn't. And we've still got more than 25% of households who have left less than 1 month's spent savings available, right? So it's not uniformly spread. The other point, of course, is that as you go into next year, the other factor here is those mortgage repayment holidays run out of smoke, right? Now, there are already some coming off. In other cases, they are being extended further, and I think the extensions will go till March. Maybe they'll extend it again. But I think that's another factor that people have sort of forgotten to incorporate in their thinking with regard to this. And we've also got some rental holidays that are now actually dropping away as well. So effectively, people have to start paying their rents at the time when some of those support mechanisms are also falling away. So you put all of this together, as I tried to do in my model, and you know the overhang vis-a-vis where I think the budget modelling is just so huge, and it gets very, very significant into the first half of next year.
And I think that it's really interesting when you look at all these different factors that we're discussing in a vacuum. You know, you've got the loan deferrals. You've got the fact that, as you say, 25% of people, you know, can't survive a month without further income.
Yep.
You look at all these different issues in a vacuum, and you go, "Wow, those are really, really big problems." But then when you grab them all and you put them and you put them in a blender and you stick them all together as they play out in reality, and then you think, "Wow, that is just an absolutely huge potential negative feedback loop of economic crap. You know, it's, I mean, you know, it's all well and good for all these people to get, you know, for all these property brokers to get up and say, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter about, you know, these people losing their jobs. I don't buy houses anyway. All right, fine. Let's just unpack that claim for just a minute here. If people don't have a job and people are struggling, they can't pay their rent. If they can't pay their rent, their landlords lose out. Some landlords are probably going to do, especially in Victoria, they're going to do a year without rent. What are their finances going to look like after a year without rent? And more than that, it's driving down rents. So even more landlords are going to be suffering. Even more landlords are going to be put into negative cash flow as a result. And that's going to create problems. And then they're going to potentially need to sell their properties because they don't want to deal with negative cash flow week in, week out in an economy where they're not quite sure about their prospects. Mm. So I think that there's this real potential. Well, not potential. I mean, it will happen. I mean, you know, to what degree is obviously the mystery, but we will see this negative feedback loop occur if it's allowed to occur. Mm. That is the big one. Like, yeah. I'm really starting to wonder how long extend and pretend is going to last for, because the RBA's balance sheet, when you compare it with the ECB or the BOJ or the Fed, is tiny, is nothing. Mm. You know, I mean, they could turn around and go, we're going to give the banks $500 trillion in, you know, in funding, and everyone would just be like, all right, today's a Friday.
Well, I have no doubt that we're going to see more QE type behavior from the Reserve Bank. I wouldn't be surprised to see that rate cut in November. I wouldn't be surprised to see more injections of liquidity. But here's the problem. Going back to my demand question, right? If in fact you've got households and businesses who are unable or who are unwilling to borrow more, that means that you can give liquidity to the banks, but the banks won't be able to do much with it. And therefore, going back to my money supply conundrum, right, which is money supply up, credit growth down, that still could continue. And in a way, just throwing more liquidity into the system, okay, you can control the interest rate and keep interest rates really low, but it doesn't necessarily solve anything. And that's the dilemma that I see. And that's one of the reasons why I tend to think on the deflationary side rather than the inflationary side, because I think we've got to the point now where there is so much liquidity sloshing around the place already that I agree the Reserve Bank can do a lot more, but it won't necessarily have a huge impact. Okay, they could take rates deeply negative. Maybe they'll do that. And if they did that, maybe they could get the exchange rate to drop significantly. And if they got the exchange rate to drop, maybe we could start importing a bit of inflation. And maybe that's what they're going to do. But I'll tell you what, the Reserve Bank has been so slow off the eight ball and slow behind in terms of its thinking for the last decade. I wonder whether they've got the intestinal fortitude to turn around and suddenly start doing that.
I think it's more likely that we're going to see, you know, something along the lines of cheap funding. You know, basically, you guys defer the loans, we'll give you X amount of cheap funding. This more or less offsets the fact that you have to capitalize it and offsets the fact that you guys are obviously going to be taking cash flow losses. So, but in terms of like sort of larger sort of programs, larger sort of intervention, I honestly kind of get the feeling from the RBA, and with the exception of those memos panicking about the property market back in April, and the government, that they don't really sort of see any of this as a sort of hugely significant issue yet. Mm. It's all sort of just, you know, steady as she goes, Mr. Sulu.
Yeah. Well, the financial stability report, which came out today, you know, talks a little bit about higher levels of household and business stress. But they say, we went into this with businesses very well positioned and it's not really a serious issue. That's basically the summary, right? I mean, it's 80-100 pages, but, you know, that's what they said. So that's an interesting observation. Of course, they've tended to have this very positive view, some would say myopically positive view, of what's going on, despite the fact that some of their data sets are rather old and I think probably don't capture the full extent of what's going on at the moment. I guess the other question to ask is, if in fact you give more liquidity to the banks, and as you say, you're supporting the banks, and if you add to that APRA with its, you know, don't worry about those loans, they're not bad loans, and you think about the ASIC responsible lending being taken away, and even the tax cuts that will allow some people to make those mortgage repayments, this is actually adds up to a bank keeper program, right? And I actually have a feeling that the unspoken agenda here is bank keeper. right? This is about financial stability. This is about keeping our banking system fed and watered, right? Never mind everybody else. And so in a way, my bottom line summation is $1 trillion to save our banks.
Oh, Lindsay David had a similar view the other yesterday on Twitter. He was saying that the fact that the borders are closed is so all the people who are expats and all the people who originated overseas can't leave their underwater mortgages here.
Well, it could be. I mean, you know, there is of course full recourse, but if you suddenly go overseas, it's going to be very hard to find you. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that later. And in fact, it did happen in some of the European countries last time around that people just left. You know, people went back to Poland and places like that. And, you know, there were just vacant properties. I mean, it's a remarkable situation that we're in. And I don't have any confidence in the RBA, APRA, ASIC and Treasury in terms of what they're doing. Frankly, I think we should basically bang the RBA and APRA together under a new head and basically do real banking, real central banking, not the stuff we've been doing. Their forecasting track record is appalling, you know. I mean, even worse than mine. And some would say mine's not perfect, but, you know, I haven't quite got the same resources that they've got. And I think, frankly, I'm doing a somewhat better job than they are in some dimensions. So I think we've got these really big structural issues, but it comes back to what we've said a few times, and you know, as we sort of come to the end of this conversation, it seems to me you've got to understand the political agenda here, right? There is a political agenda. There is a reversion to type that we're seeing. There is an ideological standpoint that has been taken. There is a set of levers that are being pulled with a particular set of outcomes. But those outcomes are more short-term than long-term. They're more about getting through to the next election and beyond than anything strategic. And with that comes huge risk, long-term debt, and the risk, I think, frankly, of a lost generation.
I mean, the risk is there. You know, whether or not it occurs is another question. I mean, I think the thing is there's so much uncertainty globally at the moment. You know, like if we see, I mean, you know, you had Steve Van Meter on recently, you know, and if his scenario comes to pass, you know, it's quite possible that you're right, that we could see a lost generation, or at the very least a lost decade in that, if that scenario is realized. But I think it just really speaks to the scale of the issue that we have. But not only that, but also just how, frankly, stupidly we've reacted to it. Yeah. You know, I mean, we've got a nation here. And, you know, I mean, you look at what's happened. You know, retail's exploded. Okay, that's understandable. You've given people low income people some money. But you look at the sales of high-end properties, of collectible cars, of all these different things. And let's just imagine that, you know, that Steve's scenario and your scenario of a sort of more serious problem is correct. And it's my scenario too, let's be honest. If that is correct, we've just pissed away hundreds of billions of dollars. We have nothing to show for it. And that's a whole heap less ammo than what we have for when the real issues do actually start. And I mean, you know, here in Australia, we sort of hit the pause button. You know, we had JobKeeper, we had loan deferrals, we had all these wonderful different things. I use the word wonderful very loosely, and we hit the pause button. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, we hit the pause button. But if you look at the US, you look at a country that didn't do those things. You look at 25 million people unemployed. You know, you look at the fact that they're looking at enormous numbers of foreclosures. Business, you know, 7.4% of small businesses have already gone bust, and that's with all these various protections and stuff in place, albeit to a much, much lesser degree than Australia. And I just can't help but look at that and think, is that our future? Is that what we're really heading for? Because right now, we don't have any plan. It's just, I mean, okay, we do have a plan. It's just a bad one. You know, it's just, we're going to go back to normal. We're going to just put everything back the way it was. And, you know, oh, hey, if we get a vaccine, we'll churn up immigration and everything will be great, and we'll party like it's 2009.
Yeah, well, the plan is to replay the last 10 years. That's the plan. Yeah. So expect higher house prices, bigger debt, all of that stuff. Doesn't fundamentally address, you know, the real issues that we've got, strategically speaking. Doesn't really address the need to migrate to a, a greener, more sustainable future, doesn't actually think about how we actually build capabilities to create more growth in new areas ahead. Those are the strategic questions that should have been addressed. Those are the questions that are missing in action. And like I say, that $1 trillion, to my mind, is being just frittered away.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, you know, we know what the focus is. We know the focus is the banks, and the focus is the relative stability of the system. And as long as the government can somehow find a way to maintain this idea that there is a bridge to the other side, that there is better times coming at some point in the relatively near future. I mean, perhaps we will see, you know, I mean, like, as you've seen in your surveys, with people being like, oh, well, I'll hold off on, listing that property until next year.
Yep.
I mean, you know, can they keep kicking that little can down the road?
I'm sure that there's another 4 or 5 years that they could. But remember this simple point, you have to do it logarithmically. You can't just do it linear. You have to actually increase the amount of stimulus like that to maintain any chance of getting any momentum, right? So effectively, $1 trillion at the moment can easily turn into $2 trillion or $3 trillion 2 or 3 years down the track if you really want to go there. But then the question is, even if you do go there, does it achieve anything? Well, look at the Japanese scenario, look at the European scenario, and even look at the US scenario. And you have to say, this whole strategy looks to me to be running out of smoke.
Oh, pretty much. It's just insane. Like someone on Twitter put it really well the other day. They're just like, it's really interesting that no one's looking at the point that the US economy needs $1 trillion in stimulus every 3 months. That no one's batting an eyelid. You know, no one in the market saying, oh, holy crap, we need to put $1 trillion into the, you know, $4 trillion annualized. And we're seeing the same thing here in Australia. You know, like, I mean, don't get me wrong. Here in Australia, that's got a lot more coverage. And I think that's been really positive that people have been discussing the fiscal cliff and stuff like that in the mainstream. There has been. I mean, I wrote some of it, so I know that there was, that it is there. So
you were the one.
There were others. There were others. But it's just, it is interesting, though, that there isn't that sort of greater concern and greater panic. And I just feel like the Australian attitude has infected the world. You know, it's like the she'll be right virus, you know?
Yes. Well, you know, I actually think that the problem is that everybody is assuming that by doing more of what you did previously, only more so, will get you to a different outcome, right? And as I may have said several times, I'll say it once again, the definition of insanity is to do the same things again and again and expect a different outcome, because I don't think that you will get a different outcome. And unfortunately, in the process, we're going to incur huge amounts of debt. There's going to be huge damage done to the economy and individuals in that economy. And the level of uncertainty and potential damage more broadly, psychologically and socially, is huge. And yet, I don't see really many voices in the mainstream and indeed in central banking land who is actually articulating concerns. Although McFarlane did actually this week in the AFR, it was covered, McFarlane, ex-RBA chief, did actually question whether in fact the RBA was actually on the right track or not. So maybe we'll get a few more central bankers, ex-central bankers, to come out and say, excuse me, maybe there's another way. Peter Tulip, of course, ex-analyst at the bank, also has come out and said they're very myopic in what they do and need a different way of thinking. So, you know, maybe there's a few, but the trouble is it's almost too late.
Yeah. I'm just curious, to be honest, just to see how all this plays out in terms of confidence, because I think that is really the key.
Yep.
At this point, you know, the Australian people still believe, I would say relatively overwhelmingly, considering the circumstances that we're in, that we are headed in the right direction, that we are going to recover, that we're going to see, you know, good times relatively soon again.
Yep.
And I think that as long as that holds up, I don't think we're going to see big precipitous drops in housing prices. We'll see drops, don't get me wrong. And especially in undesirable areas, they could get poleaxed. But in terms of just overall, I don't really see it going down the toilet. But then the moment that confidence shatters, that's it. Yeah. That's it. You know, we've had 30 years of let the good times roll, but once that finally just, you know, you're shattered into a million pieces, and all of a sudden we have to confront reality. I think it could be very different.
But then, of course, Australia is very fortunate. We have the beaches and the footy, and we can just go off and enjoy ourselves. And we're very good at just saying she'll be right and everything will be good. And look, I'll be honest with you, I would prefer to be here in Australia than almost anywhere else around the world at the moment, given the broader economic context. But that doesn't give us a free pass just to sort of not try and tackle these more strategic issues. So I think it's a matter of watching and waiting, seeing what happens. Unfortunately, the budget's the budget. It'll be passed, of course. But I think that also, you know, I've said a few times, and I just underscore it again, this isn't going to get fixed in just a few weeks or a few months. This is going to be a long, slow grind. And I do think that we might look back in 5 years' time and say that point, that budget, the budget on the 6th of October, 2020, was where effectively the big mistake was made. And we missed the opportunity that if we'd gone a different route, we could have ended up somewhere different. Well, we'll see, I guess. When we make our show in 5 years' time, Tariq, we can see whether we're right or whether we're wrong.
Yeah, and I think that overall that the music can probably keep going a lot longer than people think. You know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, it's all going to be over with soon and everything's going to go down the toilet and everything's going to implode. But I mean, if the government did nothing, or they actually kept to their word of ending JobKeeper in September, then yeah, sure, it'd be a very, very different story. Hmm. But in the world of extend and pretend and trying to prop up confidence, you know, we could see all of this, you know, go for quite some time before it finally just goes.
Yeah. Well, to use a very old and outdated analogy, right? This is not just a single. This is an EP, right? An extended playing disc. It will go on for quite a lot longer than people think.
Yeah, exactly, mate.
Good to talk to you today. Thanks again, and we'll catch up again very soon.
Yeah, no worries, mate. Looking forward to it.
Cheers. Take care.